Totally Football Show. Today, after Tigers' Masters triumph, we've got all the major football questions. Who'll get teed off midweek? Who'll get let down by their clubs? And can Man United do a comeback, despite, like Tiger, needing surgery at the back and often getting in trouble at home? Also, Liverpool-Chelsea, Drake curse update, and seagulls dropping ahead of that massive Brighton-Cardiff clash. That's all in the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Oh-ho, listener. You lucky thing, because we've got some Michael Cox for you today.
Hi, James.
Plenty more of that on the way. Daniel Storey is in the house as well.
Good morning.
And they're joined by Ian Irving.
Hey, James.
Hi, Ian. You'll be speaking to Premier League supporters around the world later on today through FanZone.
I certainly shall, yeah.
Do you know who your guest will be?
Yeah, it's Dion Dublin in the early one and Mark Bright on the late one, as always.
It is the most eclectic programme of any kind.
It amazes me every single time. You don't fail to get a gem from a corner of the globe that you never imagined. Last time we had a Huddersfield fan on from Canada asking if he could still be on next season when Huddersfield Town are a championship club, and of course the answer was no.
No, not unless he picks another regional side to follow.
Well, he's a big Huddersfield fan, so yeah. Right. Yeah, I think he's nailed his colours to the Terrier's mast firmly.
Big events going on this week, Ian. Bournemouth blew the relegation fight wide open. Burnley maybe close it up again. We'll see. There's a massive game coming up on Tuesday as Brighton host Cardiff. And Fulham did a win because Everton. Now, big game was at Anfield. Very special Salah goal. Michael, I thought of you in the first half, actually, when Chelsea were looking very composed and resolute and all the kind of things I don't associate with Maurizio Sarri. Were you enjoying their performance?
I thought they were the better team in the first half after a 10-minute spell of Liverpool pressure. I thought they were excellent at playing through the press, actually. I thought Jorginho, Rudiger and Luiz were kind of tempting Liverpool up the pitch, and they were pushing the ball beyond their lines really quickly. I thought Kante showed why Sarri likes him in that role. I thought Loftus-Cheek was quite good at almost playing as the big man because they didn't play with a proper striker. They could go direct to him. I mean, we've become accustomed to Liverpool. They have really big spells of pressure at the start of both halves and then kind of tire. And it wasn't the first spell of pressure that did it. It was the spell after half time.
Which was exactly the story last time Chelsea went to Merseyside, no? When they had that fine first half against Everton and then it all fell apart and they ended up losing 2-0. Exactly what happened here. Was Rudiger going off for Christensen? Was that part of what changed?
Yeah, partly. Because like we've been mentioning there, Rudiger was actually playing a good role in the game. The issue that Chelsea had was as soon as he got the ball up to Eden Hazard, it felt like he was quite isolated, and unless he was going to take on two or three players at any given moment, which he can do, but it felt like that was the only way through it. I never liked Hazard in that role, to be honest. It's been talked about loads, so I won't go over it again because it's boring, but he likes playing with Olivier Giroud. Chelsea win more matches when Olivier Giroud plays. So I don't really understand why Olivier Giroud doesn't play more, but like I say, it's been done to death, really, hasn't it?
Can we think of a tactical reason that if Giroud's playing Hazard's out on the flank and against Liverpool's fullbacks, would that be an issue?
Yeah, well, the reason he didn't play Hazard on the left is because if you play on the left, particularly against a team like Liverpool, you are expected, you're going to have to track back, otherwise you're going to get potentially overlapped at left back, and obviously Emerson Palmieri has just come into the team. Having said that, I don't think the benefit you get from that necessarily outweighs the danger of Hazard playing on the left where he prefers to play, because it basically meant that unless they scored the perfect goal, Liverpool were pretty comfortable at the back. And the way Chelsea have defended, particularly away at the top six, they were always going to concede at some point. And as soon as they did, yes, they did have chances when Hazard then went to the left, but it kind of felt game over as soon as Liverpool scored the first goal.
That first goal, was it a story of hunger?
Well, it was a story of Jordan Henderson being in the final third, and we should point out that he was the one that went to Jurgen Klopp and said, Gareth Southgate has played me here for England. I quite like it. I think I'm quite good at it. If the front three's getting a little bit stale, maybe it's a way of creating more space for them if I can get into the penalty area. And lo and behold, he gets there, chips the ball back, and there's 5 yards of space for Sadio Mane to head the first goal in. So, yeah, fair play to Henderson for that, because... And fair play to Jurgen Klopp for taking it on board and listening and going with it as well, because it's given Liverpool's season a little push just when they needed it.
Right.
Fabinho as well is working now exactly the way that Liverpool intended when they signed him in the summer. He had a slow start to the season, but you look at the way he sort of controlled midfield at times yesterday. His passing, I think, is better than Henderson. It's a bit more incisive at times. And there's just a greater sense, it feels to me, of control now with Fabinho in that role and Henderson a little bit further forward.
Barely had time to appreciate that opening goal. that Mo Salah had pulled something quite extraordinary out of nowhere.
Yeah, and I think it's also worth pointing out that Henderson made a really good run for this goal as well, which dragged Loftus-Cheek out of the space that Salah motors into. Obviously, there's still a hell of a lot for Salah to do from that position, but it was the key feature of the game. It was funny watching this on Sky because Liverpool went 2-0 up and Jamie Carragher was kind of imploring Liverpool to attack more and deliver the knockout blow, but everyone talked about the Gerrard slip game in the build-up, but this was more like the one at Crystal Palace where they went 3-0 up and then collapsed because they were trying to score more goals. And that did worry me a little bit from Liverpool's perspective. I think they do have a tendency to get carried away with momentum and emotion. And that was a time really where they should have been killing the game. And Chelsea probably should have scored at least two goals. Right. I mean, there were the two hazard chances and the one when Azpilicueta probably should have pulled it back. So they did have a real wobble for 10 minutes.
They were a lot better at controlling the emotion than last time, though. I mean, I've been hammered in here before and argued about this several times, about the emotion of that title push with the Gerrard slip and Christian Bull and all that sort of stuff. But I do think this time around there's a bit more measure to them. I understand exactly what Michael's saying there about them having that moment, having that wobble and sort of pushing for more and all this sort of stuff. But if you think back to that, I mean, the Chelsea game in 2014, you know, Chelsea were quite happy just to draw 0-0. Liverpool should have just been happy to draw 0-0. But like we say, the emotion and everything else and people lying in the streets, you can look that in two different ways maybe. But it just felt to me like it all got a bit too emotional last time. And actually, from Liverpool's perspective, I'm quite encouraged that we're not quite at those levels for them.
Although they did have a dizzy 10 minutes or so after the second goal. Maurizio Sarri goes to the bench and brings out Gonzalo Higuain, who's got the wrong kind of hunger.
He's just, this is not just glorious hindsight. I wrote it at the time, I thought he was a wretched signing for Chelsea, not just because he's not at it anymore, but because he's such a still a big name that Sarri kind of feels obliged to turn to him, because if you don't start either striker and then you bring off Olivier Giroud, then Higuain's finished. And he's already come out and said, I'd like to stay at Chelsea next season. If they're going to have a transfer ban this season, then Chelsea might well want to keep him around, particularly if Eden Hazard's going to leave. So he kind of feels obliged to bring him on. But yeah, he's just not very good at the moment. He has a couple of touches and everyone thinks, oh, he's playing nicely. But you know, this is a guy who scored consistently throughout his career, and he doesn't look like having chances at the moment at Chelsea.
He's in Sheva mode.
I think he is carrying a little bit too much weight. People in glass houses throwing stones. But the main problem is that Eden Hazard prefers to play with Olivier Giroud. Right. And he's made that completely obvious all season. And Sarri has basically ignored that. And in doing so is probably annoying Eden Hazard as well as annoying Olivier Giroud. So.
This season, Giroud, 17 starts, 15 wins, 2 draws. It may be that a lot of those games have been against weaker opposition, but Chelsea are winning matches with Giroud in the team.
Already, Chelsea, despite this defeat, are still in the top four, 2 points ahead of Man United and 3 ahead of Arsenal. Man United, though, have a game in hand on Sarri's team, and Arsenal have a whopping 2, one of which you're going to be watching this evening at Watford.
Yeah, tough game considering Arsenal's away record.
That is true. As for the title, mention the winds of destiny, the raw emotion, the momentum powering Liverpool past each successive hurdle. But if City do win all their games, the title is theirs. The latest victory for City being that 3-1 win over Crystal Palace in what looked like not the easiest of fixtures.
They struggle there historically, or they have struggled there. They struggled against Palace in particular at home as well, of course, earlier on in the season. But simply, this game proved one thing to me, and it's a very encouraging sign for City, and that's that Kevin De Bruyne is back. Mm. It looks now like his fitness is up to the level that it needs to be. We spoke to him, I interviewed him, I think it was February time, and he was saying, don't expect me to be back to my best until next season. The injuries have taken a lot out of my season, and actually getting back up to full speed, I'm going to need a pre-season. And I wouldn't say he's back at full speed, but when you watched him at Selhurst Park, he's beginning to find those passes that you didn't see until he played them. His fitness is there more, his pressing's there more. I think that's a massively encouraging sign for City.
Kevin De Bruyne, by the way, I read that assist was his first in the Premier League for 336 days.
First this season in the Premier League. 2 assists at Selhurst Park, he'd not had one all year. I think he had 16 in the league last season. Crazy. I mean, considering the standard City have set again this year without arguably the best player from last season. I mean, Bernardo Silva's done a good job of filling the gap, but I always think with De Bruyne, you watch him and he gets the ball and you don't even see what he sees, and he produces passes. You're up, you can be up at the back of the stand with a massive view of the whole pitch, you know, the perfect tactical view, the perfect view to pick these sort of passes. You don't see it, and he sees it at pitch level in the heat of the midfield battle. I think he's an incredible player.
There's an amazing video on YouTube, like 80-minute long video on YouTube of Michael Laudrup's passes. It's a passing compilation, and you can play an amazing game where when he gets a ball, you pause and guess where the pass is going to go, and you'll get it right less than half the time, I promise you. It's amazing.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Aspo2K19 says, if City are to drop points now, if at all, will it come versus Tottenham or Man United?
I mean, Liverpool have got the easier running. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But City have got this head of steam that, yeah, might depend on their result in the Champions League this week and their continued participation in that competition. But they are better than every other side that they are going to face for the rest of the season in the league. So
Liverpool have four more games. Cardiff away, Huddersfield at home, Newcastle away and Wolves at home. For Man City, five games. Spurs at home, Man United away, Burnley away, Leicester at home, Brighton away.
It might be Burnley if they do drop points.
At Burnley.
It could be, yeah, because the record there, similarly like we're saying in Crystal Palace, has not been great. They lost there back in 2015. They won narrowly 2-1 with Burnley back in the Premier League, drew 1-1 as well there. They have struggled a little bit against Burnley's style in the past too. So personally, I don't think they will drop points. I think they'll power through and win them all, to be honest. And I think Liverpool will as well. And it'll be the most cruel title race ever, I think.
Almost anticlimactic. Having seen this incredible sprint, generally in title races, we need kind of light and shade and needs to be a little bit nip and tuck. So, oh, they drew, but oh, they've lost the next day. But when both teams just win every game, it almost becomes anticlimactic.
Surely there's a twist out there, Michael. There's always a twist.
Yeah, if I had to bet, I'd guess that City would drop points in one game, but still win it on goal difference. I don't know which of those games it will come against, but they are tough fixtures. To win all those five is, I'd say, improbable.
If both teams win all the games,
yeah,
Liverpool, I can't remember, someone tweeted this at the weekend, Liverpool will get to 97 points, which means that the defeat to City would stop them not only winning the league, it would stop them being another invincible team by going the whole year unbeaten, and it'd also be prevented from being another Centurion team as well, all by that
crazy.
one defeat.
Really shouldn't have lost that game, if only they'd known.
Yeah, absolutely. They tried to win it, didn't they, I think?
Yeah. Okay.
Raheem Sterling again and Mohamed Salah, both of whom kind of made the difference in their teams at the weekend, having suffered pretty horrible periods of, you know, with Salah's, the racist abuse of Salah last week again, being investigated. It kind of, all power to them for stepping above that and kind of setting the example and setting the news agenda after pretty horrible news stories.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually, Raheem Sterling's comments, and we'll maybe touch on this later on, because there was a case in France of a game being suspended after a player reported racist abuse, and Sterling saying that he actually doesn't want that option to be taken up. He says he'd rather not leave the field. He'd rather stay on the field and beat the opposition.
Raheem Sterling's point has always been that focusing purely on the on-the-surface incidents and, you know, allowing those to set the tone actually enables governing bodies and societies in general to avoid scrutiny of that kind of inherent, inbuilt racism. If he doesn't feel like he wants to walk off the pitch when he's been racially abused, if he'd rather score a goal and, you know, cup his ear like he did with England in Montenegro, fair play to him.
All right, next up then, we'll talk about the Champions League. Two Manchester sides, both looking for big comeback wins. Will they get them?
It's never been easier to mess things up. Whether you're confusing vegans with dairy intolerance, offering your seat to a pregnant lady who isn't pregnant, or like Liverpool, chucking away a 7-point lead at the top of the Premier League in a matter of weeks. Good one, lads. That's why Paddy Power do money-back specials, so not all mistakes cost you as much. Paddy Power. Home of the Money Back Special. Applies to first bet on all losing goal scorer, correct score and what odds Paddy bets on the match. Max refund £10. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Champions League this evening. Here's Stefan. Which Champions League tie second leg will cause the biggest upset? ? United to come back at Nou Camp, Ajax to trash another giant away, Pool somehow to collapse in Portugal, or Caneless Spurs to finish City hopes? What do you think, Michael?
Which would be the biggest upset?
Yeah, which one would be the biggest upset? Which do you think is actually going to happen?
None of them.
None of those. All right, Stefan, there you go. Liverpool, of course, looking comfortable.
Thanks, mate.
after their 2-0 win at home to Porto. Juve and Ajax is delicately poised, 1-1 from Amsterdam. The Manchester sides, as we mentioned, both needing comebacks. Man City, a goal down, taking on a Spurs side who, yes, are without Kane and Dele Alli and Harry Winks as well, but coped admirably against Huddersfield at the weekend.
Yeah, they brushed them aside, as teams are wont to do against Huddersfield. I think Winks is the... I mean, obviously Harry Kane's a massive loss, but the fact that Winks has got another groin injury so soon after, it feels like he comes back, shows us what we've been missing, shows us what England potentially have been missing, and then picks up another injury. And obviously Victor Wanyama played at the weekend. I can't remember. It must be a long time since he's played two games in 4 days. I don't know if they're going to play Eric Dier there, who's on the bench, but that's the problem. With Kevin De Bruyne coming back to form, that central midfield is going to be so hard for Spurs. Obviously, if they score and Heung-min Son will start, he was rested at the weekend. If they score, then City need three. But yeah, I fear for them. I said last week on the show, I thought it would be a low scoring. Spurs might be able to nick a win in the first leg, but I fear for Spurs away and stick with that.
Will Lucas Moura get another run out in the starting lineup?
He deserves it, doesn't he? I mean, it'll definitely depend on what the tactical plan is for Pochettino, because Llorente did play a lot the last time when Kane was injured. I doubt he'll go with Llorente, though. I think it would be Lucas
Llorente
Moura.
Did Llorente pick up an injury at the end?
That might be the decision for him. I doubt he'd go with Llorente anyway, to be honest. And I think when a player's got a hat-trick like that as well, you just throw him in, don't you,
really? They need to play on the counter. If Ali is injured and they can keep Eriksen high enough up of the pitch to kind of link play and just have Son and Moura on the last men and hope to nick a goal on the counter, that's the only way they're going to do it.
But Ali will play, won't he?
That sounds
Ali
a pretty good way. Oh, you think Ali will play with
I think he'll play, yeah.
He's injured at the... I don't know.
Well, he's broken two bones, hasn't he, in his hand. But, I mean, his wrist. But people have played with that before with a lightweight
Jamie
cast
Vardy
on.
Was better with his broken hand, wasn't he?
Was he?
Yeah, he actually kept the cast on after it had healed, for luck.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to do that?
I wasn't going to stop him.
Yeah. I always have visions of Eric Cantona scoring that free kick against Arsenal with a broken hand as well.
Right. What do you think, Michael?
I think City have to play quite cautiously.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know it's an obvious thing, but if they concede one goal, they've then got to score three. So I just think they've got to play for the clean sheet almost. Because they probably will score one, maybe two goals. So I think if they really throw the fullbacks forward, you know, Spurs have got the players to hit them on the counter-attack. So I think we'll see the fullbacks quite narrow and quite a structured team from Guardiola. I can imagine people being slightly bemused by his team selection one way or the other, as tends to happen in these Champions League games.
But City have been kind of warming up for that kind of performance with recent games, not so much the one at Palace, but we've seen them kind of eking out these 1-0 wins.
I thought it was interesting to hear Guardiola basically say pre-match Palace that he rested players against Spurs because he felt that Palace was the bigger game, and whatever happened at Spurs, he would back his team to overcome it in the second leg, which is a hell of a gamble.
He played it cagey. The idea was to be cagey, wasn't it, effectively? I wonder with Guardiola as well, sometimes, this is real nitpicking considering his record, but I do wonder sometimes whether he overthinks these type of situations.
Do you think? That's not something that's been suggested.
No. I mean, he's quite intense, isn't he? When it comes to this occasion, you just wonder how much his recent Champions League record, being as bad as it is in these type of matches at this stage of the competition in the last, 7-8 years, how much that does play on his mind. Because, like you say, you know, he is a man known for analysing, scrutinising every last little drop of detail.
Daniel, you've got City going through?
3-0.
Wow.
Really?
Ian?
3-0.
City, but 3-0 is a push.
It is, isn't it?
Mm.
Just about fancy Spurs, actually.
Do you?
Oh, God.
Clean sheet at home is a really big deal, isn't it? Going away second leg, so yeah.
Certainly is.
3-0.
What about Man United? Can they do a Man United in Barcelona, handily enough, in Barcelona?
Has Solskjaer ever been to the Nou Camp before?
Did you see that thing?
Really,
the latest one was that story about I didn't park in the manager's spot at Carrington because I thought that was Ferguson. I mean, you normally allow other people turning into a parry. Don't deliberately make yourself a parody?
I was curious about that because it's not a direct quote from him. It's sources at the training ground suggest that he'd turned down Parkey and Sir Alex Ferguson at the manager's spot because he said, no, that's Sir Alex.
I mean, all evidence at the moment points to it, though.
I mean, this might be quite a logistical thing in the car park. Like, Ferguson's still coming into training.
Exactly.
It might, you know, he's been unwell. It might be the space next to the door.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Making me sound like I hate the aged and disabled those goods.
Do you think there's a social backlash underway then?
I don't think there's a backlash, no. I think there is a... Well, firstly, I think there's a returning to... about the right level. I think they overachieve in terms of results as per, you know, against performance, and now they are getting about right. But
right.
They were dreadful against West Ham.
Indeed, and you were there, Ian. I'm wondering as well whether the press are beginning to tire of his sunny truisms.
Yeah, they are, yeah. When he first arrived, you know, any mention of Sir Alex Ferguson or trebles or 1999 or any of that was met with sort of a lot of typing and a lot of scribbling because people were quite excited about those type of lines. And after the Barcelona game, Ollie was sort of talking generally about going there and the challenge for the team and stuff like that in quite sensible terms. And at the end, just couldn't resist the little nod of nostalgia that he put into the end of the answer about, we know a few things about scoring from set pieces in the Nou Camp. And he actually heard a groan, an audible groan in the press conference.
Fair enough, though.
Yeah, and
he's sort of joking as well.
He did have a sort of smirk, a smile on his face at the time, and I wonder how much he's actually aware that people are probably a little bit fed up of it, and he's just going to continue
well,
anyway.
You saw the performance against West Ham, which you described as what, dreadful, pick an adjective.
Not good at all. Yeah,
and you saw the one at home to Barcelona last week.
Yes.
Do you see any chance of them turning this around? Like they did at PSG?
No, only because I don't think Barcelona will play as badly as they did at Old Trafford. Having scored the early goal, Messi basically dropped into central midfield and they stuck with what they had and they didn't try and push for any more goals, which I think was probably a mistake because I think United were probably there for the taking, but they obviously wanted to guard against, protect the lead they had, and I think they'll play better in the Nou Camp than they did at Old Trafford.
They will be without their goal scorer, Luke Shaw, on this occasion.
Indeed. Yes, I think they'll manage.
Okay.
Just a couple of things on that.
Yep.
And PK said before that first leg that it was really, really important that if you had the chance to score a few goals against Manchester United in this first leg, that it was really important for Barcelona to do that and try and kill the tie from the first leg, because he sort of, not only was the PSG example used, but he was sort of talking about how the spirit of the club generally, they're not the type of team that you want to leave alive, I think was the line from him. Also as well, picking up on Luke Shaw, that's a massive issue for United, in my opinion. He's probably the one defender that you wouldn't really want to lose for this particular game because of him playing on that left-hand side. And I actually think him and McTominay a little bit, but also Chris Smalling dealt pretty well with Lionel Messi at Old Trafford.
It is improbable United doing this, but then so was Roma getting that win last season, pushing Barcelona out the quarterfinals for the third year in a row. Not the third year in a row, but Roma have done it. But they have got a disastrous record at this point. Michael, do you want to take a contrary stance on this?
Not for the sake of it. I just think Barcelona is so good at retaining the ball, they'll frustrate United for long periods.
Okay.
And I think United will have to push higher and actually go searching for the ball, because otherwise Busquets will just stand on it, and if no one comes, he'll pass it sideways, and that will happen 700 times. So I think it's an uphill struggle for United.
It's okay. Really weird in the West Ham game in that obviously Solskjaer made some changes, but you'd think he would at least say to those players that came in, let's try and win this game in the style that we tend to play against Barcelona. They gave West Ham so much space in midfield. The sort of space that if they replicate that against Barcelona, they'll lose by 3 or 4 goals. You know,
Ollie said that afterwards. That it, if we repeat this performance, we'll get beat 3 or 4. You know, that was the exact point.
West Ham, what, 18 shots that they had?
Yeah, and I think they had 58% possession at Old Trafford. I mean, I don't think that's ever happened, even when you had really great West Ham sides in the past. I've certainly never seen it in my lifetime at Old Trafford from a West Ham team. And like Daniel was saying, just the freedom of it all. And United scored 2 goals from penalties. And other than that, you know, the chances that came in the game, you're thinking back to West Ham's goal, which was actually onside.
The
he should have
Anderson
been allowed.
Goal that would have opened the scoring.
Absolutely. You're thinking to Antonio producing a fantastic save out of David De Gea in the second half at 1-1. Also hitting the bar at 1-1. You know, it's those type of... Yeah. It's not Manchester United coming close or anything like that. West Ham could and maybe should have won that game.
Mm. Oh, one last thing about United, who remain just outside the top four. Have you were there at the weekend?
Yes.
Have Old Trafford security managed to find out why that huge sex toy was at the bottom of the... Which dugout was it? Was it home or away?
Next to the home dugout, yes. Yeah, just next to it.
And there was this large black...
I've seen it, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I do sit near there, but I can confirm it wasn't in my possession at any point during the afternoon.
Okay. That's the uncertainty, shall we? It wasn't Ian's.
Was it Alan Irwin's? The Sky Sports News reporter.
That's what you're looking at.
That could have been any of us, that.
Were you there?
Yeah. I was reporting from Finch Farm on that deadline day.
Okay.
It's like the butterfly effect, but with purple
dildos. This is the this was the Everton Sky Sports News transfer deadline day report.
Yeah.
Do you think you were the only person that was in both places?
There is sort of a
interesting.
Yeah, there's a link there, isn't there? So,
well, I'm moving on.
Elementary.
All right. Yeah.
Porto Liverpool.
A dildo denominator, if you like.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. Thank you.
Porto Liverpool. Liverpool 2-0 up as they head to the Dragao, where they won 5-0 just last season. Mane got a hat-trick there. Will he get rested? Is Klopp going to basically give some of the lads a breather in this one, do you think, Michael?
Maybe one or two. I don't think there'll be wholesale changes because I was at the first leg of this game and I thought Porto showed some promise going forward. Mariga up front was really dangerous. He scored in his 6 previous Champions League games. He actually spent the day of the first leg being violently ill, I gather.
Right.
So it was a surprise he started. So if he has a week of training and eating properly, then I'm sure he'll be much more dangerous.
He did score at the weekend, yeah.
Your man's back as well, Michael.
Herrera.
Herrera, yeah.
Yeah, who also scored at the weekend. Oh, nice. Porto beating Portimonese. Brahini scored. They didn't go top, though, because Benfica did more. Benfica, so we'll talk more. Have you been watching Benfica?
I saw they won 4-2 at the last night.
Yeah, and it's...
I think they've got an 11-goal difference advantage over Porto.
We'll talk more about Benfica later on.
How Felix.
Hector Herrera's back. Michael, you like him. Pepe, you're a big fan of him as well. He's also returning from suspension. Liverpool have to be wary of complacency, but
Pepe was suspended. That's got to be a first, hasn't it?
Meantime, the other Champions League quarterfinal second leg is between two sides who are really impressed in the second leg of their last 16 clashes. Juventus and Ajax 1-1 this from the game at the Johan Cruyff Arena. Juve really struggled against Ajax. Do you think they're going to kind of turn it on in the second leg, or do you see Ajax doing another of those 4-1 away at the Bernabeu?
I think Ajax will dominate the game again, just because I think both sides are quite content with that situation. I mean, Juve were dangerous on the counter. They had that chance at the end with Costa, didn't they? And I tend to think that they will do that again and get more goal-scoring opportunities. I also think the big blow for Ajax is Taliafico being out, because that was such a big part of their attacking approach. They almost overloaded the right and then left him free for switches. And the nature of his booking was really strange. Did you see this? Mm. So it was quite a complex situation, but there was a foul between two players.
Yeah,
referee played advantage. He then almost didn't realise he was playing advantage, so fouled someone. The referee brought it back for the free kick, but also booked Taliafico, which, in the letter of the law, is fine. But I can't imagine that there's ever been a situation where a team has been so disadvantaged by a referee trying to play an advantage, and I thought he was really, really good. So
there's also question marks over Frankie de Jong after he was taken off about half an hour into their performance at the weekend. Just the 6 goals for Ajax at home to Excelsior. A hat-trick from Huntelaar, another 2 from Tadic. But nobody's quite sure. I think the club have been quite cagey about whether De Jong whether it was precautionary or whether he's actually going to miss out on this game, which would have potentially a huge impact against the Juve side, who are, by contrast, welcoming back all sorts of players, potentially like Emre Can. A lot of talk that Chiellini's going to be fit as well, who'd be a very welcome return indeed.
It's tough, though, isn't it, for a player who's... I mean, it's a hamstring problem, we understand, for De Jong, and even as a very minor thing and being taken off as a precaution, with the game being so soon, that's a massive risk, and I guess because of the occasion, it might be one that Ajax do risk, but easily 1 minute in, that hamstring can go. But players are always very, very nervous playing with any sort of hamstring niggle at all, even if it's been sort of 3 or 4 days recovery.
I thought their best player first leg actually was Donny van der Beek, who I must say is one who's gone slightly under my radar, but his man marking Pjanic and then pushing past him to get into goal-scoring situations, I thought was really impressive. He doesn't get as much praise as De Jong, but he was brilliant.
Generally, their press, though, on Juve were completely bamboozled by now.
Yeah, my fear for Ajax would be, over the years, I think Juventus are quite good at learning lessons from first legs and just the players adjusting, you know, things themselves, not even necessarily a tactical change, but just players realising this is my challenge, this is what I'm up against, and improving for the second leg.
Well, certainly that's what happened in the last 16 when they were 2-0 losers against Atletico Madrid and quite the opposite when they hosted the...
There's a lot of Champions League know-how as well in that Juve squad, isn't there? I mean, that was the one thing that struck me about them at Old Trafford earlier on this season. It was men against boys in terms of the level of experience some of those players had, and especially now in the knockout stages. I mean, that is a... for me, is a massive advantage for Juve over Ajax.
In terms of those with not so much experience, Moise Kean got another goal this weekend. He's now on 7, which means he's the highest scoring teenager ever for Juve, breaking Alex Del Piero's debut season. So, you know.
And
also getting a run out as Juve made radical changes to their lineup this weekend and promptly lost 2-1 at Spal, was a young Englishman, Ian. Tell us more.
Yeah, Steffi Mavididi. Steffi Mavididi. He's not a player that I noticed moving to Juve back in the summer. We were talking about it before we came on, and I was sort of asking Michael and Daniel about it. Michael knew a little bit more than I did. But yeah, he's born in Derby. He joined Juve last summer from Arsenal. He's 20 years old. England under 20 international. He got a run out towards the end, and it'll be interesting to see how he gets on, because, you know, again, we've talked about it so much about the guys over in Germany. It's not a path that well travelled in recent years for young English players. So good luck to him.
Although Ennio Lucco's doing a slightly more high profile job for Juve's women's team.
Yeah, Arsenal have lost a couple of promising young players. Marcus Maguire at Barcelona B as well. And you have to say it's a bit of a failing at Arsenal, I think, over the last 20 years. Of all the top clubs, you expect them to be bringing through youngster after youngster. But there aren't that many that have come through and made it in the first team, considering this is kind of Wenger's legacy, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Aaron Ramsey, of course, will be joining Stefan Mavididi next season.
Yeah, I was sort of meaning for young players who are,
right,
you know, he was joining, leaving Arsenal to join essentially Juve's reserve side, you know, and continue his development there before stepping up.
Yeah,
to
which
the first
he did.
Team.
He was down in Serie C last season.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting.
Yeah, doing a Pogba, as it's known.
Yeah.
Right, Connor Cartwright, quick note on Ajax Juve from last week, says James Horncastle's got it wrong. As an avid fan of all things house and techno, I almost choked on my disco biscuits when James classified that horrendous music as techno, the genre of music DJ Norman was subjecting your listeners to, which sounded, by the way, like this. Be cool, Daniel.
Happy hardcore.
What do you know about happy hardcore, Daniel?
Little enough for me to remain with dignity intact.
Okay, happy hardcore, or even hard house. But never, ever, ever, says Connor Cartwright, techno. So now you know. All right, we'll take a quick break with that. And then, what do you want to talk about? It could be Europa League, or it could be the absolutely massive game at the Amex on Tuesday. We'll find out, listener, after this. Hello, Daniel. It's growing on me. Now, Daniel and Michael, you're both taking part in the London Festival of Football Writing this May. What are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about 250 Days, Eric Cantona's Kung Fu Kick, and the making of Manchester United.
Fancy a bit of that. Saturday, 25th of May. But anyway, you can find out all the details at londonfestivalofootballwriting.org. londonfestivalofootballwriting.org. The tickets are dead cheap. You can either get a festival pass, that's £30, or individual tickets for £7.50, the likes of which will gain you entrance to seeing Michael discussing with Adam Hurry zonal marking the making of modern European football. That's on Thursday, the 23rd of May. Nice.
I'm sorry to say that tickets have sold out.
Oh,
but you can put your name on a waiting list, and if there's enough people, then we'll do a second one.
There'll be some at mine if you want to get some overspill. I'm happy to take Michael's seconds.
Wow. You sold out. Fantastic. Oh, by the way, there's a promo code. You can get those tickets even cheaper by entering the promo code TOTALLY. You get 20% off.
That is good.
They're virtually paying you
it's
to go.
It's now worth coming.
Yeah.
Might get some friends interested if it's money off.
Always a good idea.
£6 to come and see me.
Quick word on Europa League.
Yeah.
Because it happened last Thursday. And it's going to happen all over again this time.
I was at Arsenal. Napoli.
Oh, were you? That was Napoli. Well, anyway, Arsenal, moreover. We were mentioning Aaron Ramsey. Bosh. That's my match report.
Yeah.
They look comfortable. I'm sure Napoli will be better at home, but still, talk about getting caught cold.
Yeah, it was a funny game where I think both managers were disappointed at the end. I think Emery was disappointed Arsenal didn't finish off the tie, and Ancelotti disappointed they didn't get an away goal, because there was a period in the second half where Arsenal thought were defending too high up the pitch, and Insigne, who was, you know, a bit of an injury doubt before the game, looked absolutely fantastic in the second half. I think Napoli will rally and have a serious spell of pressure here, and I do think Arsenal may wobble. I think the consolation for Arsenal is that whereas Socrates is suspended domestically, he will be fresh, and I think they will need him because he's, I think, their most solid penalty box defender.
Hmm. Okay. Chelsea, meanwhile, have a 1-0 lead from their trip to Prague, courtesy of Marcus Alonso. Elsewhere in the Europa League, Valencia have a 3-1 advantage against after the first leg at the Mestalla over Villarreal. Two goals in stoppage time there, actually. And Raphael Honigstein's pick for the trophy, Eintracht Frankfurt, are teetering on the brink of an exit after losing their first leg 4-2 to Benfica at the Stadio da Luz. Now, Benfica, there was a hat-trick in this game from the player everybody's talking about, João Félix.
Indeed.
Who this weekend went and added another... What did you get? You got two assists and another... Did you see his goal? Benfica were playing Vitória Setúbal. They once again won 4-2. And he lashes this... I'm not sure who the ball comes from, but somebody just crosses the ball. And he lashes it in from some distance. He's an absolutely stunning talent, this guy.
Yeah, we typically have needed to be slightly wary of strikers in Portugal scoring hatfuls of goals and then going elsewhere and struggling slightly. My obvious example is probably the worst Premier League striker I've ever seen, Ricky van Wolfswinkel, who scored hatfuls of goals at Sporting and was dreadful. At we termed him at Football 365 Ricky van Dogcock.
Crikey.
Because of Wolfswinkel.
Well, don't go making up any names like that about João Félix, who's only...
No, yes. Not in a poor cold water all over.
Tom Kunda, a.k.a. Portugal.
Yes.
He says... Well, he points out it's 16 goals in 37 games now for João Félix. In 25 years, says Tom, following Portuguese football, I can't remember another teenager making such an impact in his debut season.
It's also worth saying that Portugal, for so long, one of the themes of kind of our... footballing education is Portugal desperately needing a centre forward that can score regular goals in international football.
What's wrong with Pauleta?
Exactly. It should also be said that Eintracht Frankfurt went down to 10 after about half an hour in that game, which killed them. But getting that goal means 2-0 at home is not out of the question.
Well, we'll see. Gets the mighty João Félix and company.
João Félix, incidentally, was 6 years in the youth system of Porto. And then they've released him.
No way.
Yeah.
Ouch.
And he's going to go for 50, 60 million probably. Right.
Well, there's more foreign football talk on the way, including a pretty important update on the whole Drake curse thing. If you are a sportsman and you are anywhere near Drake, I urge you, do not let him take a picture with you, because the consequences are serious.
If that hotline blings, don't answer.
Absolutely. Nice. That's a Drake reference.
I assume
reference.
He sings that song, doesn't
he?
Good to know.
Back to the Premier League and Tuesday at the Emex. Brighton will be hosting Cardiff. Oh my word. Brighton are reeling from defeat, in which Jonathan Pearce was desperate to describe as a relegation dogfight against Bournemouth. Did you enjoy Jonathan's stylings over the Brighton-Bournemouth game?
I did enjoy one bit where he said, and the cross comes in, it's 1-0. No, it should have been 1-0. I thought that was a classic piece of commentary.
That's not the same, is it?
The thing is, the table is not on his side. A lot of people were commenting on social media, what's he going on about? Bournemouth are safe, pretty much, and Brighton are 5 points clear of Cardiff with a game in hand. But Jono Pearce, I suspect, has looked at the fixtures coming up, which sees them basically finishing off the season away at Arsenal and home to Man City, so could easily be nil point there. Before that, they're home to Newcastle and have Spurs away and Wolves away, and this Tuesday, that game in hand against Cardiff. Seagulls have lost their last four games in League and Cup, conceding 10 goals and scoring none. Tuesday, then, they'll be taking on a Cardiff team who are angry.
Yeah, they are angry. Brighton have, more long-term, they've won three league games since December the 4th, which is really wretched. And there are, for the first time, serious murmurings of discontent among supporters. I think, to an extent, Houghton is a victim of his own success, and it's only a few months ago since everyone was kind of saying, oh, why is he not talked for bigger jobs, etc., etc. But his default football is negative, is to be safety first, and it's not working at the moment because they're defending. Duncan Duffy, who have been brilliant pretty much ever since promotion, have fallen off a cliff, and so they're conceding too many goals.
Why is that? They didn't look very intense.
They don't concede many goals, though. That is really, really rare for that to... I can't remember Brighton capitulating like that at home.
Themselves have been in horrible.
The big issue is that their football, very much like Newcastle's, worked on Friday. Their football relies on the big centre-forward holding the ball up, and Glenn Murray looks goosed, basically. He looks very tired.
He didn't start the game, though.
Exactly. Yeah. He's been in and out of the team. He's knackered, and it just means there's no respite for Brighton. So teams are just getting to play on the front foot against them. Anthony Knockhart was an embarrassment on
Saturday. So, yeah, that had a bit of a bearing. What was the scoreline when he went
off? It was 2-0 when he got sent off. Yeah. Right. The thing is with Brighton, you look at their home record, you know, I think only Burnley has scored more than two goals there all season in the Premier League. And that includes, of course, people like Liverpool, and they only scored one there. Tottenham going there, City final day of the season there at Brighton. So it is really, really unusual.
Does it speak to there being some kind of background issue at the
club? Well, yeah, the rumours are that some of the players are slightly unhappy at the negative tactics and have kind of made their feelings clear. And whenever you lose 5-0 at home to a team that have been wretched away from home for a long time, it points to a pretty significant issue. Now, if they fail to, as long as they avoid defeat against Cardiff, I think they'll stay up. But the club's kind of got some big decisions to make over the summer, because if they start next season how they've ended this, suddenly they're in a bit of a rut. And
it'd probably do them a favour, the fact they've got this Cardiff game, because the last thing I think you'd want if you're Brighton is having to stew on that sort of result for any longer than you need to. And the fact that they've got a game at home where they can get that result straight out of the system right away, it is probably a positive. That said, if you don't beat Cardiff, or maybe a draw's
draw
okay.
would be okay. No, we could keep that 5-point margin.
Yeah, Cardiff.
But you've talked about the other games, though. They might not get another point. You know,
you mentioned Brighton's fixture list. Cardiff's last four is also
so Cardiff's
absolutely
last,
horrible, isn't it?
They after Brighton, they have Liverpool at home, Fulham away, Palace at home, and United away. So you can see them picking up maybe 6 points there.
Yeah. It's not out of the question.
Can Brighton avoid defeat without Anthony Knockhart at home to Cardiff on Tuesday, Michael?
Yeah, and I think the absence of Knockhart might work quite well for that fixture, because I think they'll need to be solid and compact and disciplined, and he's very much not that kind of player.
Okay, what about Cardiff, where one of the big surprises of the weekend was Neil Warnock's self-control as referee Mike Dean repeatedly robbed his battling Cardiff side of a chance of getting a result at Burnley?
I don't think the penalty he wanted was a penalty, though.
Which one did he want?
The one that Mike Dean changed his mind on.
Oh, yeah.
I think he got the right decision in the end. There's an element with Warnock of, because he gets angry about it, everyone assumes there's some massive controversy that's stitched up his team, whereas actually they played really poorly and they didn't deserve the Mike Dean penalty that he thought they should have had, and they're going down.
The Gunnarsson one, though? Would you not have given him a...
Maybe,
you know, to be charitable?
But it's not. We buy into these refereeing controversies because it's all anyone talks about now. Mm. Like, it forms a backbone of... I've said it on here before, but the backbone of Match of the Day coverage and stuff now. So because Warnock then... he reacts to it as well. Every time there's a decision that goes against Cardiff, it automatically becomes a big story. It doesn't mean it was a penalty.
It was the correct decision, you know, if you analyse it, to not give a penalty. I think it's the process that you can understand why Cardiff are probably upset about it, because having been awarded it, you know, was it 1-0 at the time as well? So, you know, was it even 0-0 maybe at the time?
What?
0-0. So it's a massive moment, that, isn't it, really? And for a referee to give it and then undo it, you know, you can understand why they would be frustrated with that, even if it's the correct decision eventually.
Another fine performance from Burnley's Dwight McNeil and from the incredible goal machine that is Chris Wood. Mr. Underscore says, who is the best Wood or Woods to play football? All Wood-related items for surnames are welcome. Oh. In fact, maybe Woods 11, says Mr. Underscore. By now,
not much of a... You've not given as much... I'll have Chris Woods, the goalkeeper.
You can have Chris Wood, Michael Branch. These are misters.
Good.
I had a look into
Stefano. Oh, did you? Sorry.
I had a look into it. Yeah, I just couldn't see the wood for trees, to be honest.
Wow. I'll just have Nottingham Forest.
Can you have Bannister?
I thought you said, can we ban Ian?
Can we ban Ian?
Okay, Stefan Oakes. These are Ryan Woods. Leroy Fur. Oh, yeah, that's clever. Fair okay,
yeah, Michael's got one.
Kingstonian had a player last season called Evan Green.
Oh, nice.
A bit like Evergreen, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is quite like it.
Yeah.
Near enough.
Actually, Westwood.
Close enough for no prep time.
I was going to say, I can't do much better than that.
What about Forrest? James Forrest, who scored that brilliant goal for Celtic in the cup tie against Aberdeen this weekend.
Craig Forrest as well, wasn't the goalkeeper?
Yeah, but I've done
Chris Woods conceded 9 goals at Old Trafford.
Anyway, right. While we're down there, strangest result possibly of the weekend, Fulham beating Everton 2-0.
No, this was in the form guide because as any Premier League stats fans will know, Fulham against Everton is the game that always ends in a home win.
Oh.
So there's been 28 Premier League games between them and 23 of them have been a home win.
Okay.
And I'm delighted to learn that even with a relegated side, this stat still pulls through.
Brilliant. Okay, Fulham with a clean sheet and everything.
Yeah, that'll probably be enough by the sound of it to get Scott Parker the job on a full-time basis, which both...
Tom Kearney was asking for.
Yeah, sort of sums up how bad Fulham's season's been, that you can win one home game and that get you the permanent job. But, yeah, looks like he's going to get it.
Saints look like they've sealed safety with a 3-1 win over Wolves, whose season's kind of fizzling out a bit, but
they've got a negative goal difference now, Wolves, which is weird considering all the pros they've been getting.
Yeah, they're still up in eighth, though. They could still finish seventh. They're only 3 points behind Leicester.
But it's a bizarre season in that they've taken, I think they've taken 1.2 points a game for away game against the top six and 0.2 points for away game against the bottom five. It's just a nonsense season.
Yep. Leicester, by the way, who lost at home to Newcastle. And Daniel, you were there. Very quick match summary for anyone who didn't see it.
Yeah, I was in the away end, actually, with mates who are with Newcastle fans. And I know they get talked up all the time, but the Newcastle fans were absolutely magnificent. That basically confirmed them staying up. And they stayed after the full-time whistle for kind of 20, 25 minutes in the stand chanting because Benitez was still waiting to come out and do his Sky interview.
What were they chanting?
They were chanting one of their Newcastle chants.
What was it, Daniel?
It is... Who's that team we call United? Who's that team we all adore? They play in black and white. Something about a fight, I think, which is a shame.
Yeah.
The one conclusion I'd make from the game is that this probably pitches the two best strikers outside the top six, I think, with all respect to Raul Jimenez. Yeah, Rondon is... It's not particularly pretty sometimes, but the way he holds up the ball, I can't remember which manager, but there was a Premier League manager this season that said Rondon's the best player, best centre-forward we've had to play against, or the hardest centre-forward we've had to play against. His holding up the ball is incredible, and he's left so isolated as well.
He's a very good free kick taker as well, which I didn't expect for a big man. He's got this nice technique where he side foots it really powerfully.
Ooh.
I think that's a good result for Liverpool, by the way, because if Newcastle are safe, I don't think Benitez will want to take points off Liverpool penultimate game of the season and deny them their long-awaited Premier League title.
Interesting.
We've got Connor Cody on the final day, happy to score an own goal against Liverpool as well.
Okay, hang on. Got this text message in. This is from producer Ben. For Mr. Underscore's wood-based team, Arno Splinter, who's a Netherlands voetballer, it says here on Dutch Wikipedia. So you've had to dig a little bit for that one, producer Ben. Nice one, though. Okay, after this, crazy goings on around Europe and in the Championship.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsors of Melchester Rovers. Find out more at RoyTheRoversOfficial.com.
The Championship, Leeds, where we'll be tonight for Totally Football Live, are back up to second after they beat Sheffield Wednesday 1-0. Sheffield United could only draw 1-1 with Millwall, so they trail Leeds now by 3 points. Aston Villa made it 8 wins in a row, beating the previously high-flying Bristol City 2-1. That's nice. Tony Pulis got his second win in a row with Borough because they've been in trouble. And Ipswich are down, Daniel.
Yes, they are. Yes, and it's been coming for about 5.5 months.
Okay, they're going to be in League One, where they will be facing next season
Lincoln City.
Bang! The incredible Cowley brothers continuing their march up the footballing pyramid. Who else will they be facing? Well, possibly Joey Barton, depending on what happens to him after his extraordinary ruck Well, alleged rock.
Better.
Yeah, OK. With Barnsley manager Joey Barton, of course, in charge of Fleetwood. Barnsley manager Daniel Stendel emerged from the tunnel after they beat Fleetwood 4-2 on Saturday. Emerged from the tunnel with blood pouring from his face, and police apparently had to pull... Well, there's a suggestion that the forces of law enforcement had to pull our Joey off Daniel.
Seems a strange punishment. The amusing image, the most amusing image away from the serious trouble, was a police officer who had clearly been sent into the car park to go and get or stop Joey Barton leaving, who ran past the car that Joey Barton was sat in the front seat in to go and try and find him, and Barton just drove out the training ground and then had to stop outside the ground. It was great. It's all very serious business, though, should be said.
We'll have more of that kind of thing in the Totally Football League show, where they'll also be discussing the 9-goal thriller between Coventry and Sunderland. We also have a Totally Scottish Football show, as you may know. They will discuss the Scottish Cup final, which will see Hearts heading to Hampden to take on Celtic, who beat Aberdeen 3-0. Neil Lennon still on for the treble. Andrew Slave and JJ Bull and Laura Brennan will be in for that. Might be actually up now, even as we speak. Golanzo, our Italian football podcast. You can hear Gabriele Marcotti lamenting the exit of Chievo, the Flying Donkeys. They're now mathematically down, and Gab will be most distressed about that. Ian, he hates Chievo. Oh. Really hates Chievo. Mm-hmm. Plus, we'll be talking about whatever mouldy old bit of history decide to dig up.
What's he got against Chievo?
Oh, well, tune in and find out. Okay, I'll ask him that question.
Yeah.
And that'll be the show, basically.
Okay. Yeah, Gab.
Germany, meanwhile, there was a flurry of excitement as Dortmund briefly went back on top of the Bundesliga. Two early goals from Jadon Sancho, putting them in the lead at home to Mainz. Mainz made it 2-1, but then Bayern came back and beat Düsseldorf 4-1. So they're back on top. And hello, France. So now we've been talking. Who was asking about the Drake curse? Daniel.
I was. Okay. Not
so
really up on
basically, we mentioned previously that he'd taken a picture with Jadon Sancho, and that was right before Dortmund lost 5-0 at Bayern Munich. He took a picture with Aubameyang right before Arsenal lost at Everton, although, you know. And he also took a picture with Aguero right before the Spurs game. I think it was the Monday before the Spurs game, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Although, why was Sergio Aguero at a concert? I don't know. But anyway,
he took a picture with him, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Aguero misses the penalty and blah, 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 blah. This weekend, there's a picture of Drake with Levan Kurzawa of PSG, who you will recall were off at Lille. All they had to do was avoid defeat and they would have won the title. What happened, Michael?
Lost 5-1.
Indeed. And had a man sent off.
Heaviest league defeat in 19 years.
19 years.
PSG.
Yeah. And I mean, they were rubbish for a lot of that as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's true, yeah.
Bernat scored and then got sent off. Is that right? Sending off kind of ruined the game. And that's when it all fell apart.
Yeah. And Lille can be quite a decent team.
I do wonder if Thomas Tuchel... I wonder if Thomas Tuchel will... What will happen this summer? I mean, Julien constantly says he'll absolutely stay, but tumbling out of the Champions League at home to Man United and kind of limping over the title line in Ligue 1 is not a good look, is it?
It takes a gloss off it, doesn't it? You know, you're sort of talking about a team that's absolutely dominated Ligue 1, you know, for the entire campaign. I think this is only the second game they've lost all season. But that was their second chance to actually get over the line. Obviously, everyone will remember the Choupo-Moting miss that cost them the week before. Mm. And now they've got a third chance on Wednesday against Nantes to do it. And when you've dominated so much throughout the season, to then that final bit just to get over the line, it just takes a gloss off it a little bit, doesn't it?
Lille's goal, incidentally, was headed in by José Fonte, who I think is probably the only player to win the European Championships and the Johnston Paint Trophy. But if I'm wrong, please correct me, listeners.
Who did you win the JPT with?
Southampton.
Yeah.
Okay, back in the day.
Yeah, they signed him when he was in League One, so he really rose up through the divisions.
Oh, brilliant. Nice one. On Friday in France, Amiens' game at Dijon was suspended for 5 minutes, as we mentioned earlier, when Amiens captain Prince Guano told the ref he was being racially abused. A fan was later arrested and the game resumed.
Essentially, I was talking to Dermot Gallagher about this subject last week as well, and he said that in his idea that the referee should be in control of the situation. So he wanted, you know, a player to come to him and say to him about what had happened, and then the referee and the match officials take the decision to appropriately deal with the situation. He said that, to his mind, was better than the player taking action themselves.
No, but I think that totally makes sense. It's just so rare to actually see a referee suspend a game. Remember, in Italy, it happened when they had this rule ages ago that games would be suspended if there were offensive banners. And the only time it happened that I can remember was when Colina stopped a game because there was an anti-referee banner. There was a referee insulting Catherine the guy who's in charge of you. Everything else, yeah, you're fine. Anyway, ooh, did you see the own goal for all eternity in MLS?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you meant the one in the semi-final of the Women's FA Cup.
Oh, Ericsson. Yeah, that was unfortunate.
It's inexplicable. It's one of those own goals.
I think just bounces off her foot, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but
this is Man City beating Chelsea 1-0 with...
Yeah, bearing in mind, it's the 92nd minute, it's 0-0, right. Chelsea have been the better team.
Yeah.
The cross comes in from Demi Stokes and it's just going basically into an area of the Chelsea penalty area. Right. There's three centre-halves. There's no City forward of any description anywhere near them. And she just, I don't even know what she was trying to do, but sort of half bounces her, she's trying to clear it and just loops into the corner.
Okay, significantly worse than that, I have to say, having seen
both. Oh, really?
Yes. Wow. Yeah.
Okay.
This is Sean Johnson, who is the NYCFC, New York City FC goalkeeper. And how to describe what happens in the game against Minnesota? It's 2-2.
It's the worst confident first touch I've ever seen.
Right, so the ball is passed back to him. And he
kind of makes some, as if to, goalkeepers do quite a lot, sweep it with the outside of their foot to push it out, to give them some space, then run and kick it. But he sweeps it straight back into his own goal, basically, yes.
Oh, that is significantly worse. I've just watched it now, yeah.
I think the consolation, not for the goalkeeper, is that he got enough of a touch so that it's his own goal and not the outfielder's own goal.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, because sometimes, for example, Gary Neville shouldn't be credited with that own goal that went under Paul Robinson's foot, because it's not his fault, it's Paul Robinson's foot.
Or the divots.
Or the groundsman's foot, right.
Yeah, yeah. That game finished 3-3, by the way. In other exciting MLS action news, Frank de Boer's Atalanta got a big win. Yeah? 2-0 away at New England Revolution.
Fair to say that De Boer's managerial career needed that.
Right. But because they had Almiron, though, who was, everyone was very excited. The guy who's kind of stepping up is Ezequiel Barco, who scored both goals. I don't know if you've seen that. It might be the first or the second. I'm not sure. But one goal's really special. Basically, he bends it about a billion miles. It's fantastic. Well, oh, Barco, producer Ben points out he could get into the tree. 11.
Good, fine.
Yeah.
I thought you called him Barcode at first.
No,
how modern would that be? Yeah?
Yeah, well, a Brazilian football called Argentine, Barcode.
Do you remember that Brazilian substitution when John Lennon replaced Michael Jackson? Because they're both, there's two players named after, obviously named after musicians.
All the other way around, nobody knows. But speaking of barcodes, the most unfortunate story, and now we really are wandering a bit, the most unfortunate story of the week came from Argentine football.
I didn't realise that this was all done on Twitter. This was all grassed up on Twitter.
And this was actually...
The tattoo guy.
Yeah. So he gets a tattoo of the QR code that will show you a Libertadores goal by...
It will show you the replays of a Libertadores final on YouTube, yes.
Right.
River Boca final, isn't it?
Yeah,
is
that's
it?
What it was.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And then, so basically, once people discovered this, and it genuinely worked, there was footage of people scanning with their phone
It's on his shin,
tattoo,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the phone then showing the goals. And so a fan campaign was launched to notify YouTube of the copyright, because like all these goals, they're always there. So the video's been taken down.
But it's great. Yeah. Someone just it just says, right, campaign to grass this guy up.
Awful. Amazing. Anyway, very good. Let's find out about odds and that on the midweek European games and more. Producer Ben talking to Paddy Power.
Thank you, Jimbo. Lee Price from Paddy Power is on the line, listeners. And title race, Schmeichel race, Lee. Let's talk about the Champions League. Are Spurs going to knock City out so we never have to hear the word quadruple again?
Well, why not? Kane's out and Son will lead the line, presumably, so they're perfectly set up to play on the counter at Tottenham. But Man City are pretty good in the front foot, aren't they? And that's why Pep's men are odds on 4-7 to qualify here. Tottenham are 11-8 to go through. Overall, City are joint second favourites with a big Jugear trophy alongside Liverpool. They're 10-3 to win the Champions League. Tottenham are more distant, 14-1. Barcelona, of course, the favourites. They're 5-2.
All right, what about United coming back and winning the tie versus Barcelona? Can they do it?
If that night in Paris is one for the romantics, I think a repeat in Barcelona might be one for the fantasists for United. They're 8-1 to turn this around and qualify. By contrast, Barcelona are 1-16 to go through. And yes, we know this was a happy hunting ground for Solskjaer in the past, but we expect the only cries of Ole to be from the home fans. Sorry.
Our friend James Horncastle is lucky enough to be going to Turin this week to see Juventus and Ajax. Can the Dutch side knock out the old lady?
Well, that Ajax first leg was very impressive, wasn't it? But it didn't impress the traders. We're betting against Ajax here. Juve at home, 8-13 to win this. Ajax are 4-1. The Dutch side will probably outplay their opponents, full of effervescent energy and attacking brilliance. And then Ronaldo will probably knock them out. He's odds on, 8-11 to score any time, because of course he will.
And finally, from Champions League to Championship and the battle to get there or actually not get there, are Cardiff going to beat Brighton and give Neil Warnock something to finally smile about?
Well, they need to, don't they? Else it's all over. Cardiff are 1-25 to go down. So for context, you have to bet £25 to get a single quid back. They're doomed. Although Brighton were rocked at the weekend and in woeful form. Even so, this match we think will be a case of toddler of chips, easy picking for Seagulls. 10-11 they win this, 10-3 Cardiff do, 11-5 is a draw.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com. All prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's 18 plus only, begambleaware.org, and when the fun stops, stop. Very good. We're off to Leeds now. I say we. I'm off to Leeds now with producer Ben. Mm. What have you got planned for your weekend? You're going off to do Fan Zone obs.
Mm-hmm. I'm covering United Barcelona from Manchester.
Nice.
Which is a different way of doing it. And I'm actually in Brussels at the weekend on a stag do. So that's my week.
I'll hear nothing about that.
How nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. How nice. Michael, what does the week hold for you?
Watford Arsenal tonight. Yep. And then I'm up to City against Spurs on Saturday, which is really exciting because there's no trains to Manchester. So that should be a fun trip. I don't know. Engineering works, I expect.
But it's Easter.
Yeah.
That's why they do it, isn't it?
Okay.
Are you familiar with Virgin Trains, James?
I'm about to be.
Yeah. I am at Man City Spurs on Wednesday and then Arsenal Palace this weekend. Michael's doing Arsenal City, I'm doing City Arsenal this week. Swapping's over. Unnecessary clarification admin for me there.
That's enough of all this kind of thing. Listener, thank you for being with us. We're back on Thursday with Duncan Alexander, Alvaro Romeo, and in other exciting accented news,
how does Barry White feel to it?
Yep. We'll be analysing all that Champions League action and so much more. Do join us then. For now, bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com, and don't forget to check out our other football podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand. Supporting your team can be a beautiful thing, but then come the injuries, the goal droughts, and the downright disastrous defeats. That's a little bit like life, really, and here at the Totally Football Show, we believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the good days and the bad. And that's why we're continuing to work with CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. On average, 12 men take their own life every day in the UK, so that's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. And part of the problem is that many of us still feel uncomfortable talking about mental health and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it the most. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that CALM is there. Every day from 5 p.m. till midnight, CALM provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about CALM.